Chapter 19. Kai felt warmth on his face, and a cool breeze caressed his skin with fragrances of glittering oceans, long grasses, and exotic spices designed to inflame the senses. He wanted to open his eyes, but some lingering anxiety made him keep them shut, for fear that this precious moment of peace might be snatched away from him. He knew he was dreaming, and the realization of that did not worry him unduly. The life he had left in the waking world was one of pain and fear, emotions he did not have to face in this state of limbo. Kai stretched out his senses, hearing the soft sighing of water on a beach, the rustle of wind through high treetops, and the emptiness of space that can only be felt in the greatest wildernesses.
"Are you going to make your move, Kai?" asked a voice that came from right in front of him.
He knew the speaker instantly, the golden figure he had pursued through the marble cloisters of Arzashkun. Hesitantly, he opened his eyes, surprised for some reason that he could do so. He sat on a wooden stool before a polished regicide board on the shores of the lake beyond Arzashkun's walls. The game was underway, and the silver pieces were arranged before Kai, the onyx ones laid out before a tall figure clad in long robes of deepest black. His opponent's face was hooded, but a pair of golden eyes glittered deep in the blackness within. Embroidered words in fine black thread were stitched into every seam and fold of the fuliginous robes. But Kai couldn't read them, and gave up trying when the figure spoke again.
"You have come a long way since last we spoke."
"Why am I here?" asked Kai.
"To play a game."
"The game's already begun," pointed out Kai.
"I know. Few of us are granted the privilege of being present for the beginning of events that shape our lives. One must look at the board one is presented with and make of it what you can. For example, what do you see of my position?"
"I'm not much of an expert on regicide," admitted Kai,
as his opponent pulled back his hood to reveal a face that shimmered in a haze of sunlight that danced through the waving leaves of this oasis. It was a kindly face, a paternal one, yet there was a core of something indefinable, or perhaps undefined, behind that mask.
"But you know the game."
Kai nodded.
"The choirmaster made us play it," he said. "Something about making us appreciate the value of taking the proper time to make a decision."
"He is a wise man, Nemo Shimeng."
"You know him?"
"Of course. But look at the game," insisted his opponent. "Tell me what you see."
Kai scanned the board, seeing that a number of the pieces were hooded, making it impossible to ascertain their loyalty. From what he understood of the game's complexities, it appeared there could only be one outcome.
"I think you're losing," said Kai.
"So it would appear," agreed the figure,
drawing the hood from one of the pieces.
"But appearances can be deceptive."
The revealed piece was a warrior, one of nine remaining to Onyx, rendered as an ancient soldier in gleaming battle plate.
"One of yours," said Kai.
"Then make your move."
Kai saw the revealed piece had been pushed forward as part of an aggressive opening, but had been left unsupported by its fellows. Kai moved his divinitark from a nearby square and took the piece, placing it on the side of the board.
"Did you mean to sacrifice your warrior?" asked Kai.
"A good sacrifice is a move that is not necessarily sound, but which leaves your opponent dazed and confused," said the figure.
"I was told that it is always better to sacrifice your opponent's pieces."
"In most cases, I would agree. But real sacrifice involves a radical change in the character of a game, which cannot be effected without foresight and a willingness to take great risks."
And so saying, the figure swept his fortress down the board and toppled Kai's divinitark. The piece in the figure's hand glittered in the sunlight, seeming to shift from black to silver and back to black.
"The sacrifice of a warrior is most often played for drawing purposes,"
said the figure with a sad smile.
Against the very strongest players, it can prove to be quite useful. And one of the advantages of playing so risky a gambit is that the average opponent knows little of how to defend against it.
What if you're not playing an average opponent? Asked Kai. What if you're playing someone just as clever as you?
Kai's opponent shook his head and crossed his arms.
If you allow timidity to guide your play, then you will never achieve victory, Kai. All you will find are new ghosts to fear. Too often you allow the fear of that which your opponent has not even considered to keep you from greatness. That is the truth of regicide.
Kai looked down at the board, enjoying this moment of calm in the pain-filled nightmare his life had become. That it was a temporary fiction made it no less real at this point, and Kai had no intention of rushing to embrace the madness of his waking life.
"Do I have to go back?"
he asked, moving his Templar forward.
"To the Petitioner's City?"
"Yes."
"That is up to you, Kai," said the figure, repositioning his Emperor. "I cannot tell you which path to choose, though I know the one I would wish you to take."
"I think the warning I have is for you," said Kai.
"It is," agreed the figure. "But you cannot tell me yet."
"I want to," said Kai. "If you are who I think you are, can't you just, I don't know, lift it from my mind?"
"If I could, do you not think I would have done so?"
"I suppose so."
"I have seen a great many things, Kai, but some secrets are hidden even from me," said the figure, indicating a handful of hooded pieces that Kai was sure hadn't been there a moment ago. "I have watched this moment many times and replayed our words 1,000 times, but the universe has secrets it refuses to reveal until their appointed hour."
"Even from you?"
"Even from me," said the figure with a wry nod.
Kai took a deep breath and rubbed his eyes. The skin around them was irritated and sore.
"The choirmaster always said regicide was about truth," said Kai,
as they took turns to move their pieces across the board.
"He was right," said the figure, moving his Emperor another square forward. "No fantasy, however rich, no technique, however masterly, no insight into the psychology of your opponent, however deep, can make regicide a work of art if it does not lead to the truth."
Despite Kai's averred lack of skill in regicide, the game appeared to be balanced in neither player's favour, though he had more pieces remaining. After the opening salvos and the mystery of the middle game, it was clear the end game was now in sight. Both players had lost a great many pieces, but the lords of the board were coming into their own.
"Now we come to it,"
said Kai, moving his Empress into a strong position to trap his opponent's Emperor. In the early stages of their game, Kai's Emperor bestrode the board with confident swagger, while his opponent's had remained steadfastly in defence. But now the Master of Onyx drew nearer the fighting line. Their pieces jostled for position, and Kai had a growing sense that he had been lured into this attack. But he could see no way his opponent could win without the ultimate sacrifice. At last, he made a confident move, sure he had the Onyx Emperor boxed in by his cardinal pieces. Only when the robed figure moved his Emperor boldly forward did he realize his error.
"Regicide," said his opponent.
And Kai saw with growing admiration and shock how deftly he had been manoeuvred into baring his neck to the executioner's blade.
"I don't believe it," he said. "You won with your Emperor. I thought that almost never happens."
His opponent shrugged.
"During the opening and middle game stage, the Emperor is often a burdensome piece, as it must be defended at all costs. But in the end game, it has to become an important and aggressive player."
"It was a bloody game," Kai pointed out. "You lost a great many of your strongest pieces to bring my Emperor down."
"Such is often the way with two equally skilled players," said the figure.
"Do we play again?"
asked Kai, reaching for the pieces lost in the game. The figure reached over and took hold of Kai's wrist. The grip was firm, unyielding, and Kai sensed strength that could crush his bones in an instant.
No. This is a game that can only be played once.
Then why is the board ready to play again?
Asked Kai, seeing that all the pieces were restored to their starting positions without him having touched them.
Because there is another opponent I must face. One who knows every gambit, every subtlety, and every endgame. I know this because I taught him.
Can you defeat him?
Asked Kai with a mounting sense of unease as a shadow moved on the edges of the oasis.
I do not know, admitted the figure. I cannot yet see the outcome of our meeting.
The robed figure looked down at the board, and Kai saw the pieces had moved once more into a convoluted arrangement that defied interpretation. He looked up and saw his opponent clearly for the first time, seeing the burden of an entire civilization resting upon his broad shoulders.
How can I be of service? Asked Kai.
You can go back, Kai. You can go back to the waking world and bring me the warning Sarashina gave you.
I'm afraid to go back, said Kai. I think I might die if I do.
I fear that you will, agreed the figure.
Kai felt a cold knot in the heart of his stomach, and the fear that had consumed him since the Argo returned with a sickening lurch. The sky darkened, and Kai heard muttering voices raised in argument from somewhere far distant.
You're asking me to sacrifice myself for you.
No sacrifice is too great for the scalp of the enemy emperor, said the figure.
Cold mist gathered around the many benches bearing laboratory equipment, and the hum of generators could be heard beyond the insulated walls of the low-ceilinged chamber. Banks of equipment that would not look out of place in the halls of a Martian geneticist whirred as centrifuges spun clinking vials of raw materials. Incubators nursed gestating zygotes, and vats of nutrient-rich liquid fostered the growth of complex enzymes and proteins. That such a well-equipped laboratory existed on Terra was not surprising, but that it was to be found in the heart of the petitioner's city was nothing short of miraculous. It was akin to finding a fully functioning starship buried in the ruins of Earth's prehistory. Babu Dakal tended to a silver incubation cylinder in which a chemical soup of elements bubbled with life. The clan lord's armor had dulled with condensation, and the dying flesh of his face was limned with hoarfrost. He no longer felt the cold, as he no longer felt pain or heat or pleasure. One by one, the joys that made existence such a gift were dying, just as he was dying. Dakal's former master had wrought him to be faster, stronger, and more powerful than any of the feral barbarian gene-sept warriors that claimed fealty over humanity's birthrock, a soldier to drag their world back from the anarchy into which it had fallen. Those had been golden days, when the eagle and lightning banner had marched before unstoppable armies of thunder warriors. Battles had lasted weeks on end, with body counts in the millions, and duels of titanic warlords that sundered mountains and split continents. Those victories were now dismissed as lurid hyperbole, and historians now refuse to believe that such clashes of arms could possibly have been fought. Why their worthless hides were not flogged for this dull-witted blindness was beyond him. But in his heart of hearts, he knew that this dreary new age could not sustain such legends without scoffing at the Sturm und Drang of those heady, bloody days. Dakal remembered toppling the Azurite Tower with his bare hands, and wondered what the scuttling little remembrances that documented this shining bauble of an Imperium would make of the tales he might tell. The machine before him chimed, and Babu Dakal turned from reveries of his glory days to the task at hand. The silver steel tube vented coolant gases, and a ribbed tube gurgled as nutrient fluids drained away. The upper half of the cylinder hissed open, revealing a gauzy mesh cushion, upon which lay a glistening organ of raw, fresh-grown meat. A web of artificial capillaries fed the organ hyper-oxygenated blood, but patches of necrotic black veined the organ like a diseased lung.
"Not another one,"
whispered Babu Dakal, his hands curling into fists.
"I am trying to correct what cannot be corrected."
He closed the incubation cylinder gently, taking deep breaths to calm the rising fury within his chest. He supposed he should be used to such failures, but he was not a man to whom such acceptance came easy. Would he have fought through 5 battle legions of grinders had he been such a man? Could he have cast down the hammer halo of the Iron Tsar had he been a man to accept failure? He gripped the edge of the bench in his thick hands, buckling the metal with his furious disappointment. Babu Dakal wanted to sweep the equipment from the benches and vent his towering fury on the laboratory that had defied him for so long, and only with the greatest effort did he manage to restrain himself. Like everything else in his body, impulse control was eroding, and he was a hair's breadth from becoming no better than the barbarian people thought him to be. Yes, he had killed men since the bitter day of Unity. Yes, he had yoked a city's worth of people beneath his rule. But had he not done that with a greater purpose in mind? A flashing red light accompanied the rattling of a decompression shutter behind him. Only one other had permission to enter this place of forgotten wonders and miracles, and Babu Dakal turned as Gota entered with a downcast expression on his face. Even his eyes, so red with blood, were hooded with failure.
"You return in defeat,"
said Babu Dakal, the word ashen and alien on his tongue.
"Yes, my Subadar," said Gota,
dropping to his knees and lifting his head to expose the cabled veins of his neck.
"My life is yours to end. My blood is yours to spill."
Babu Dakal stepped down from the platform upon which he had been working and drew a long dagger with a serrated blade from a thigh scabbard. He rested the killing edge on the pulsing artery in Gota's neck and toyed with the idea of driving it home just to feel the warm wetness of the man's blood.
"Back in the day, I would have taken your head without a thought."
"And I would have welcomed it."
Babu Dakal sheathed his dagger and said,
"This is a new age, Gota, and there are few enough of us left alive to continue the old ways,"
he said.
"For now, I have need of your heart remaining within your chest."
Gota stood and balled his fist upon his chest, a salute that had now fallen out of favour, but which still held meaning for warriors born in a forgotten time.
"Subadar,"
said Gota,
"command me."
"The men you took with you?"
"All dead."
"No matter," replied Babu Dakal. "They were but failed experiments. Tell me of these space marines. What are they like?"
Gota sneered and squared his shoulders, though he had no right to do so.
"They are not our equal, but they are warriors fit to bear the eagle."
"And so they should be,"
said Babu Dakal.
"They stand on our shoulders to achieve greatness. Without us, they would not exist."
"They are but pale shadows of what we were,"
said Gota.
"No, they are the next step in the evolution of the super warrior. It is we who are pale shadows of what they are. Yes, we are stronger and hardier than them, but our genetic legacy was never meant to last. Old night may be over, but for us a new night is falling. We were not built to live beyond Unity. Did you know that?"
"No, my Subadar."
"Our genes were always flawed, but I cannot decide whether that was deliberate or simply ignorance. I hope for the latter, but I suspect the former. This world's master is careless with his creations, and I wonder if his Primarchs know that when their task is done they will be cast aside in favor of the mortals in whose name they fight. Like the angels of old, I fear they will not take the idea of such rejection well.
Gota said nothing, the reference to the ancient text lost on him.
How many warriors did you face?
Asked Babu Dakal.
7, but 2 of them are now dead, my Subadar, said Gota. Only 5 remain.
You killed those 2 yourself?
1 of them. The other was dying anyway.
Then we must find them, Gota,
said Babu Dakal, lifting a metal device from a nearby bench and affixing it to the upper face of his gauntlet. A whirring series of needles, blades, and surgical tools snapped from the mountings with a hiss of cryo-cooled air, and Babu Dakal smiled.
We are dying every day, but with their genetic material, I may yet find a way to reverse the slow decay of our bodies. You understand the significance of this?
I do, my Subadar, said Gota.
Babu Dakal nodded and asked,
Where are these 5 warriors now?
Gota said,
In the east. I have men watching them. Word will be sent.
Good, said Babu Dakal. We will do this ourselves, my Jemadar. You and I. We will rip the bleeding progenoids from their living flesh, and we will have that which the Emperor has denied us.
Life,
said Gota, savouring the feel of the word. Moonlight pools in the open square, bleaching it of colour, but no light from the night sky can dull the vivid redness of the blood splashed around its haphazard mix of cobbles, flagstones, and bare earth. Nagasena scans the rooflines for any lingering threat, though he does not expect to meet any real resistance here, at least not from their prey. Ironwork crows festoon the eaves and ridges of the buildings, and refuse piles at the edges of the square. Debris from a daytime market, he thinks. Tossed in with the rest of the day's refuse are a host of dead bodies, at least 25, maybe more. Each one has been killed without mercy, shot or eviscerated with guns, blades, and bare hands. This is space marine killing, he says, and Saturnalia nods in agreement. Hiriko and Athena stare in open-mouthed horror at the damage wrought upon these men, amazed how disastrously a human body could be broken into pieces. They are not used to physical violence, and to see the sheer visceral capabilities of the Legiones Astartes has shocked them to their core. It is hard to see, is it not? Asked Nagasena, not unkindly. Adept Hiriko looks up, her face pale and her lips dry. She nods and says,
I know what the Space Marines are, but to see just how thoroughly they can dismantle another man's body is...
Terrible,
finishes Athena Dios.
But it's what they were created to do.
That and so much more, says Nagasena. Hiriko looks at him in puzzlement but says nothing. Athena Dios has led them to this square, following the fading, intangible thread of Kai Zulane's agony, and though it is hard for her to aid his hunters, her loyalty is first and foremost to the Imperium. She trusts Nagasena's vow of honesty, though he is having a harder time in justifying this hunt to himself. He already knows the choirmaster's explanation of why Kai Zulane needed to be found was a lie, but that does not offer him any comfort, especially in light of what Nagasena heard Athava tell his fellow escapees through the optic feed. Saturnalia and Golovko dismiss the words of traitors, but Nagasena knows that just because a man is labelled a traitor does not make him a liar. If Kai Zulane does know the truth, has Nagasena any right to suppress it? He rebuilt his life on the basis of truth being the rock upon which all things stood, and he had vowed on the ashes of his old ways never to hide from the truth or allow others to obscure it. Nagasena wonders how that will go at the end of this hunt.
The bodies are still warm, notes Saturnalia. We are close.
Who do you think they were?
asks Athena, grimacing in distaste as Cartono eases past her, making sure he does not touch her. Nagasena's bondsman pulls a dismembered arm from the wet pile of torn meat and wipes blood from a bicep that still twitches with residual electrical activity. A tattoo of crossed lightning bolts has been added to with an artful representation of a bull's head. Nagasena knows that bovine animals were once sacred to the people that lived in this region, but his knowledge of the symbol's significance ends there.
"This is Babu Dakal's clan marking," says Cartono.
"Is that supposed to mean something to us?" snaps Hariko.
Her hostility is born of nothing Cartono has done, but simply of his very nature. He has long grown used to the unreasoning hatred of telepaths, and lets her anger wash over him.
"He is a criminal," says Cartono. "The clan master of a gang that runs most of the petitioner's city. Whores, food, drugs, weapons, you name it. None of it moves without Babu's say-so."
"So how did these men fall foul of our prey?" wonders Nagasena.
"Who cares?" states Maxim Golovko. "They're traitors to the Imperium. And if they want to kill some crime lord's men, then so much the better."
"Look at these men, Maxim," Nagasena urges him. "These are not normal men."
"They're dead men,"
says Golovko, as though that is the end of the matter. Saturnalia takes Golovko by the arm and holds him fast. The master of the Black Sentinels is a position of great respect, but even he must bow to the power of the Legio Custodes. The custodian dwarfs Golovko, and his gold armor lends weight to his authority.
"Listen to what Yasu Nagasena has to say," suggests Saturnalia.
Golovko nods and shrugs off his hand.
"So, what's so special about them?"
he asks. "Look at their size," says Saturnalia.
"They're big. So what?"
"I know it is hard to tell, but I would estimate that most of these men were as tall as the men we are hunting," says Nagasena,
imagining these body parts reassembled into human form. "And that crossed lightning bolt tattoo was once the symbol of the Thunder Warriors, who fought at the side of the Emperor in the earliest wars of unity."
"What are you saying?"
asks Athena Dios.
"That these are the same warriors?"
Nagasena shakes his head.
"No, they are long dead. But I believe someone has replicated at least part of the process involved in transforming a mortal man into such a warrior."
"Impossible," says Saturnalia. "Such technology is the domain of the Emperor alone."
"Clearly not," replies Nagasena. "And the question we now face is how these men came to run afoul of our prey. I do not believe it to be simple happenstance. I believe they were seeking them out. And that means that whoever engineered these men is clearly aware of the nature of the men we hunt."
He looks down at the bodies and adds, "if not their capabilities."
"In other words, we are not alone in our quest," says Saturnalia,
reaching the logical conclusion of Nagasena's thoughts. Golovko shakes his head and says,
"Then we are wasting time,"
before leading the Black Sentinels into the square. They move like the professional soldiers they are, and Nagasena follows them out, knowing immediately where he needs to go as his eyes alight on the smouldering remains of a lean-to structure that has been shredded by heavy-caliber gunfire.
"That's bolter damage,"
says Saturnalia, levelling his spear and squaring his shoulders. Nagasena nods, unlimbering his long rifle and unsnapping the safety as he moves towards the ruined structure. He sees a host of battle indicators strewn on the ground, broken blades, torn cloth, and brass shell casings that are large enough to have been ejected from a bolter, which makes them far older models than are used today. Blood splashes and footprints show signs of a furious battle, but the scavengers who pick this place clean have obscured any tracks or clues to their prey's route. He moves to the edge of the ruins, detecting a fragrant smell he recognizes as burning quash. For the briefest moment, Nagasena remembers losing himself in a quash haze, sprawled in the silken dragon houses of Nihon, with a gun in one hand and an urge to turn it on himself. He shakes the moment loose and raises his rifle as he sees a thin-boned man seated on a tall stool, the only piece of furniture to have escaped the furious barrage that tore his home apart. He smokes a thin-stemmed pipe amid a storm of broken glass and splintered wood. Fragrant smoke drifts from the pipe's wide bowl, inviting and redolent with forbidden pleasures.
"You are a chirurgeon," says Nagasena.
"I am Antioch," says the man, his manner distracted and his voice slurred. "I am having a smoke. Would you like to join me?"
"No," says Nagasena.
"Come on," laughs Antioch. "I see the way you're looking at the pipe. You are a lover of the resin, I can always tell."
"Once, maybe," admits Nagasena.
"Always,"
sniggers Antioch, as Saturnalia and Golovko pick their way through the rubble.
"They were here, weren't they?" says Nagasena.
"Who?"
Golovko backhands the man from his stool, and he crashes down into the shattered pieces of a toppled cabinet. Glass pricks his skin, but Antioch seems not to care. He spits blood and does not protest when Golovko hauls him to his feet by his soiled nightshirt.
"The traitor space marines," snarls Golovko. "They were here. We know they were here."
"Then why did he ask?"
replies Antioch. Golovko hits the man again, and Nagasena says,
"Enough. The man is smoking the Migau resin. He will not care or feel it if you beat him."
Golovko seems unconvinced, but leaves the man alone for now. Saturnalia lifts an overturned table that is sticky with glossy blood. He bends to sniff the table's surface and nods.
"Space marine blood," he says.
"They came to you for help," says Nagasena. "What did you do for them?"
Antioch shrugs and bends to retrieve his fallen pipe. He gently blows on the bowl and it glows a warm, inviting orange. He takes a drawer and exhales a number of perfect smoke rings.
"Yes,"
he says.
"They were here, but what do I know about their anatomy? I couldn't do anything for the big man. He was dying before I even touched him."
"One of them is dead," says Saturnalia. "Who?" Antioch nods dreamily.
"I think they called him Githua."
"Death God," says Golovko with a nod. "Good."
"What about Kai Zulane?" asks Saturnalia. "They had an astropath with them, too."
"Is that what he was?"
replies Antioch.
"Fella had no eyes, right enough. Never thought he was an astropath. I thought they all lived up in the City of Sight."
"Not this one," says Nagasena. "He was badly hurt. Does he still live?"
Antioch smiles and shrugs as though the matter is no longer of concern to him.
"I've patched him up, sure. Cleaned up his eyes and packed the wound with sterile gauze. For all the good it'll do him."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean he's dying," snapped Antioch. "Too much trauma, too much pain. I've seen it before in the army. Some boys just give up when they can't take any more hurt."
"But he is still alive," presses Nagasena.
"Last I saw of him, yes."
"What happened here?" asks Saturnalia. "Why did those men outside come here?"
"The Babu's men? I don't know. But they wanted them to come out and surrender."
Nagasena nods. His suspicion that Babu de Kaal's men knew the Space Marines were here, and what they were, now confirmed. In a place like this, it would be hard to keep anything secret. But what could make a man like that actively seek to engage Space Marines in combat? Surely such a man would know how deadly these warriors would be. Why risk confrontation, unless they had something he needed enough to risk the lives of so many men?
"But they didn't surrender," says Antioch,
shuddering at the memory, even through the bliss of a narcotic haze.
"Never seen anything like it in my life, and hope I never do again. I watched them take the Babu's men apart like they were simpletons. 6 men against 30, and they killed them as if it was nothing at all. Only Gota walked away alive."
Gota. Is he one of Babu Dakar's men?
He is that, agrees Antioch. Big son of a bitch, almost as big as the men you're after. And if you don't mind me saying, I don't think you want to find them. Even though there's only 5 of them left alive, I reckon you don't have enough men to put them down.
5, says Nagasena.
Gota killed the white-haired one,
says Antioch, and Nagasena shares an uneasy look with Saturnalia. The unspoken question hangs between them like a guilty secret. What kind of mortal could kill a space marine?
Where are they now? Demands Golovko. Where did they go after you aided the escape of traitors? Oh, now I've been helpful to you, but I don't think I want to tell you anything else, says Antioch. Doesn't seem right. We are servants of the Imperium, says Saturnalia, looming over the fragile Chirurgian, who looks up at him like a child defying his father.
That's as may be, but at least they were honest,
says Antioch. Nagasena steps between Antioch and Golovko before the man can strike him. He beckons to Adept Hiriko and says, Can you find what you need in his mind? Hiriko steps gingerly over the wreckage towards Antioch. The man looks at her warily, but says nothing as she places her hands either side of his head.
What's she doing?
Asks Antioch. Nothing for you to worry about, Nagasena assures him. The Chirurgian is not reassured and looks at her suspiciously, a nervous glint in his eye.
What is she?
He asks. I am a neurolocutor, says Hiriko by way of explanation. Now be still, or this will hurt. Antioch stiffens in expectation of pain as Hiriko closes her eyes. What might the mind of a man in a quash stupor be like? Will it even be possible to lift anything of use from him? Or will his mind be like a fortress with its gates lying open and every door left unlocked? Hiriko does not move for almost a minute, then lets out a powerful exhalation as her hands slip from Antioch's head. Her eyes are glassy, and Nagasena wonders if the effects of the quash have passed into her mind.
Oh,
she says, shaking her head.
Did you get anything?
Asks Nagasena. She nods, still purging the after effects of delving into Antioch's mind. The man is fearful now, and Nagasena sees that Hiriko has rid him of the quash haze. Forced to face reality without the comforting curtain of the resin to hide behind, the world is a frightening place.
They are going to a place called the Temple of Woe,
says Hiriko.
Do you know where that is? Golovko asks her.
Hiriko looks into Antioch's eyes.
Yes, it's east of here. I know the way now.
Then we don't need this traitor anymore,
growls Golovko. Before Nagasena can stop him, the Black Sentinel draws his pistol and puts a bullet through Antioch's head.